The following was recorded in Simeon Surround. Hope you enjoy the show.
They called him King Kung Fu.
Listen, that's a circus wagon, isn't it? Don't they have trap doors in the bottom to help clean the cages? All you got to do is climb up under that wagon and pull the latch on the trap door. That gorilla will never even see him, much less be able to get at you through the bars.
Merman boy!
The scoop will be when the gorilla gets loose and goes after her.
The gorilla gets loose?
We'll just put out an APB on that. APB.
Calling all cars! Calling all cars! That's all the cars!
The fun-filled film, King Kong Fu.
Peeled me like a banana!
I'm asking for gunplay!
The mirthful master of the martial arts, King Kong Fu.
It's a strike. Long sport, though. Jones goes flying into the air. Smith follows the same routine. This gorilla truly is the monster master of the martial arts.
What do we got here?
A sissy gorilla, huh?
It is hoped that wisdom will come with age, for then you will know that fighting in itself does not bring honor, as honor is all there is which separates man from the animals.
Now, lady, I'm ordering you to clear out. But don't you believe in supporting your local police?
Look, Bo.
I have to admit, you do know how to have a good time.
Time, Captain.
Well, you just pay attention to flying this thing, Pilgrim.
What are we going to do now?
At last, entertainment for the entire family. Watch for it at your favorite theater soon. The grand opening at Wichita's Crest Theater, May 29th.
This spoiler-filled podcast is recorded live, unscripted, and intended for those over 18. Now prepare your ears for the audio stimulation they've been waiting for all day as we step into
the spoiler room.
And welcome to another edition of the spoiler room. Seems like we just had one. How can we have two in a week? Because we are just that excited. And tonight we are looking at a film that I initially had set up as a big 4-0 special, but it's not, but it is. So I could title this King Kung Fu, not a big 4-0 special, but that sounds too much like a porn parody. Let me talk about this rather obscure film called King Kung Fu. We have a great spoiler room crew in tonight. First and foremost, we have the one and only diva of the spoiler room. It is Dawn. Hello, Dawn.
Hello, gentlemen.
Great to have you back in the spoiler room. This is a film that you had put out there and suggested, and I'm just putting it out there now. So, and I'm glad you did. I'm glad you did. So glad you could be here tonight with us to talk about this film. And next to her, he has returned once again, BFD, the man himself, Mr. Glenn Bittner. Hello, Glenn.
What's up?
What's up? And next to Glenn is the man, the myth, the legend. He is known as Scotty D. Hello, Scott.
Hey, how you doing today, Mark? Good to have you here.
Well, thanks.
I'm taking over the show, apparently.
I'm glad to be on my show. I appreciate that. It's good to be here. You know, I haven't been here for a while, so I appreciate that.
This is starting to be as like rambling as like Abel Ferrara's old appearance on Conan O'Brien, if anybody's seen that.
I'm starting to think this is a Carrie Fisher interview. Anyway, if any of you aren't familiar with King Kung Fu, it's the story about an ape who he was raised in a monastery in China, and he's a talking ape. They call him Jungle Jumper. But he goes by the name when he comes to the U.S. as King Kung Fu. They send him over here as kind of a goodwill gesture. So King Kung Fu comes on over, and he crosses paths with a guy who's looking for his big break to get his break into the news business. And we see the comedy ensues as he tries to set up situations to get the big break. And all King Kung Fu wants to do is eat his bananas and see the sights, the majestic sights of the Wichita, Kansas. Wow. Don, let's go with you first on King Kung Fu. What is it about this film that appeals to you?
Well, like, I like the parody, kind of Attack of the Killer Tomatoes type feel, the slapstick, the spoof, the extremely thinly veiled references, the Ray Fay, it's funny, it's humorous, I enjoyed it. Yeah, the timing isn't always great. Yeah, it's more cheesy and far lower budget than... And to say it's a lower budget than Attack of the Killer Tomatoes says a lot. But this type of move, this type of comedy actually does appeal to me, and as opposed to like the modern Adam Sandler type movies, it's just my thing.
Well, that's okay.
We're talking about comedies.
Damn it, Glenn beat me to it. I was just going to say, well, I don't think Adam Sandler comedies lately appeal to anyone.
But, fair enough.
Glenn, what about you? King Kung Fu, how'd you feel initially about this film?
It is incredibly dated, which I think is a little bit of the charm that it still has, is that it's as Dawn mentioned, you know, the modern comedy, there is definitely something different about comedy from the 50s, 60s, even the early 70s, that is just, as far as parody goes, it's so different because it's not, if there is anything that really offends people, it's offensive because it wasn't intended to be offensive. It would be more along the lines of the, oh yeah, that's horribly racist, but this was 1958 or whenever, you know, a lot of these things were made. It's like, so that's not, I mean, it's still racist, but they weren't like intentionally doing this, hey, let's offend this group of people. So I like that it kind of harkens back to a different era of, you know, how parody was, where it relied a lot more on like slapstick and just complete goofiness, which you don't get as much. And when you do in a modern comedy, it's primarily, look at the fat guy fall down, and boy, aren't farts funny.
There are more extents than just the fart jokes in here. There's actually a number of different skits going on, if you will. It's like a series of skits that all include this gigantic ape, who's not really gigantic, but he does know a little kung fu. But yeah, I know what you mean, is that you've got to take that comedy within the context of the film, and that they were doing it back then to try to be funny, not necessarily be specifically racist. And the times have changed, and now if it came out, the internet would blow up about this film, especially about his master of the film that trains the King Kung Fu. Scotty, how about you, sir, with King Kung Fu? Be gentle.
Well, if I can quote Mr. Glenn Bittner.
No.
I will quote him right now, though. I will quote him right now as I say. That's it. I will say this in its favor. It is so innocent. It is offensive, don't get me wrong, but it's also really, but like Glenn just said, it is very, very innocent. There's a real hearkening back to the style of, yes, films of the 50s and 60s, I would go even further back into like the serials, where you have people like Smiling Jack and everything like that. So they try to make this... And then they have like the you know, police chases and stuff, and the police who are dressed, who may be dressed in Evel Knievel helmets and run like the $6 million man, but they're still kind of Keystone Cops, you know? So there's like a real hearkening back to that. Having said that, that all kind of gets blended in with like characters that I really didn't like at all, ever. And also a lot of really dated humor that comes right out of the 70s, you know, stuff about like, you know, Watergate and, you know, whatever the economic issues of that time were and stuff, you know, and you see that happening a lot in films like Werewolf of Washington from that era. It's public domain now, so you can see it everywhere, but it's really dated. And, you know, Don mentioned Attack of the Killer Tomatoes. I really get that vibe from this, because what does everybody remember from Attack of the Killer Tomatoes? They remember the theme song and how hilariously crazy the premise was. But the film itself, Attack of the Killer Tomatoes, if you look at it, has a lot of filler that's not good. And that's kind of the vibe I got here, except I would say much more so. They have the King Kung Fu character, but they just don't do anything with him, really. So, and, you know, and he's not Kogar. If you're going to have a guy in a gorilla suit, you should at least try to get Bob Burns as Kogar. It's just...
Well, I'm sure there may have been a budget conflict in here, because as I mentioned before, we wanted to do this as a big 4-0 episode. It is labeled as being released in 1976, even on the wiki. But then if you actually look at the trivia, this film was shelved in 76 and not actually completed and released till 1987, which I find fascinating in and of itself, because the film definitely is a 70s film. So to have that released in 87, it had to be really dated by those standards, especially for 87 standards. But I agree, this has innocence to it. It's just trying to be fun. It's like a bunch of friends got together and they wanted to make a movie, and they actually got some people behind it. You know, what were you going to say, Scott?
I was just going to ask, because I couldn't find any reference to how it was released, when it was finally released, if it got a limited theatrical release.
It did, actually. It did. I found a little blurb from Bob Waltersheed that said they started production in 1974, and it was released in 87 because they ran out of money several times. They said it actually played in 11 theaters across the country. It has been sold to Japan, Taiwan, and Poland. So yeah,
that actually doesn't surprise me, especially that I can see actually Japan kind of like eating this movie up.
Oh yeah.
The reason I asked that about the theatrical release is that it coming out in the mid-80s, a lot of Indian exploitation producers, I know that these were not necessarily where these guys were coming from, but a lot of the Indian exploitation producers that we look up to will tell you that the mid-80s, like say like from 85 to like 96, 97, was like a golden age for them, because VHS was so big around that time that they said we just would suggest something. We would bring anything to somebody, and somebody would release it, you know? And a lot of people actually got movies that were on the shelf that they were not able to sell when they had completed them and poured their heart and souls into them, and were able to release them much, much later. It's something that happened a few times in the 80s. That's why I asked that. So the fact that this did play a few theaters, even though I really dislike this movie, I mean, I really didn't like it. I do find that heartwarming that it did play. Come on, it's a G-rated comedy, you know? We don't get G-rated comedies. Even the animated films are PG now.
Yeah, so, you know? Yeah, that's true. And it's got some heart to it and some genuineness to it and some honesty. You know, that's what I loved about this film personally, was the fact that they knew what they were making. You know, I mean, they were just making this kind of fun comedy, and that I found charming about it. Now, I do love the cast of characters. I mean, we've mentioned Ray Jean Fay, who, yes, that's a play on Fay Wray, played by Maxine Gray, who is the girl who whose Bo Burgess tries to get to appeal to entice King Kong Fu to break out of his cage so he could get the scoop. You know, she was an interesting character. She was not blind to the guys around her. Glenn, what'd you think of her character?
Yeah.
Just eye candy?
I don't know. It kind of eye candy, but I think, I don't know, it's... yeah, it's just... As you said, this is like some friends got together, and I don't know. You also said, you know, it's they knew what they were making. You know, I don't mean to be cruel. Yeah. Often, sometimes I am, but you know, I know what I'm making after I have Taco Bell and go to the bathroom. But I don't think it needs to be released for public viewing.
Wow.
See, I'm glad he said it.
And it's like I think a big part of it is because obviously this I didn't know about this stuff about the running out of money and the release because it felt like there was just a lot of hands involved with this. There was, you know, too many cooks in the kitchen. It just because it feels. Even with little skits, it feels very disjointed and just kind of meanders. It really, really meanders a lot.
Well, it doesn't quite start off that way, but yeah, you can tell when they started running out of money because it does feel like it drifts kind of away from what they may have originally planned.
Yeah.
For this film, and so they had to come up with something else.
Well, it seems like they do that. Like, think about. I mean, Glenn's absolutely right. It seems like they have the great premise first of all with the Kung Fu Gorilla. I mean, what a great premise. And since they started production of this in 1974, they probably started production of this right when Paramount and Universal started fighting over the rights to a King Kong remake.
Right.
You know, so which was a big deal in the 70s. And so they had that great premise to blend that with the, you know, martial arts thing. They don't do anything with it.
Yeah.
Then they have the wannabe reporter. That doesn't really go anywhere. Then they have some kind of weird political thing. That doesn't really go anywhere. The woman is there just because she's a woman. She's there to be. She doesn't really have much substance. I'm sorry. She's not the actress's fault. It's how she's written. You have the exploitation factor. You have the John Wayne character. You have everything else. And everybody like kind of threw stuff in, but there's no sense that any of it kind of blends together. There's this sense that okay, and now we're just going to throw this over here and throw this over there and throw this over there. And what happens when you're like moving into a place and you say, well, we're just going to throw stuff every which way? Well, you wind up with a messy room, you know, and that's kind of what you get here.
Yeah, I can see that, that it is a messy room. The narrative kind of drifts around.
Oh, it does. I mean, I think that there's a point. I think there's a point towards the end. I mean, of course, we catch back up with Ray Fay because if you have a film called King Kung Fu, you have to riff on the fact that the gorilla is going to wind up with the Ray Fay, and there's going to be a thing at the top of a building. You know, you're going to have to do
Holiday Inn.
You got to do it. You got to do it. And so. But before that, it seems like we actually forget her for a very long stretch of time. And I'm sure if I went back to ever see this again, I would find like other little bits that you kind of like forget about for stretches of time because they're just not the cohesion just wasn't there. I didn't think.
Yeah, I can see that. Her character does kind of disappear in and out for a while, and she's there and back. I kind of liked her character though. It did feel like they didn't quite. Know which direction to take with her because one minute she's kind of standing up and saying she doesn't want to be exploited or anything, and then the next minute, you know, she's kind of doing the exact opposite. Dawn, how'd you feel about Ray Fay?
I didn't mind the character. Mm-hmm. I did. She was the reward for Bo Burgess. That's just. That's what she was. That's how she was written. But you're right. She one minute she was they were looked like they were going for a stronger character. No, I don't want to be exploited. No, this is silly. This is disrespectful, whatever. And but the next moment she's, you know, just chilling out there and almost nothing.
Well, not nothing. It was a leopard print, a fake leopard print bikini. Because
they were very clear that it was fake.
Well, yeah, because the leopard's a majestic animal.
Exactly. But yeah, she definitely dipped in and out, mostly mm-hmm. as the two characters tried mm-hmm. to Bo and
Herman.
Herman, yes.
Yes.
Mostly as Bo and Herman tried to woo her, but the only thing she seemed really interested in was the gorilla, and she was kind of feisty about that. But yeah, you're right. It did. The story definitely meandered throughout the middle. I think there's huge chunks of the middle of the movie that could have been cut out. Not gonna lie, there was a very particular part that I dozed off at because it slowed down that much.
Mm-hmm.
I did go back and rewatch it. I didn't miss much, which again supports the. There are huge chunks of this middle of the movie that, you know, the paint throwing, a lot of the snipping back and forth between the two journalists. That's not plot development. That's fluff. It's bad fluff.
They kind of break the rule of threes because in comedy and a lot of things, you know, you do something three times or shtick three times. It's funny. You do more than that, it kind of gets tiresome. They did the whole cop thing where they would always go back to the cop cars driving out because King Kung Fu finally escapes at one point in the film. And they drive out, you know, and they do it once. I'm like, okay, that's kind of funny Keystone Cop thing. And then they do a shtick like with the paint thing. Then they do another one. I'm like, okay. Then they do a third. But then they did a fourth and a fifth. I'm like, okay, guys, no.
Yeah,
I'm like that shtick ran a little long there. I'll tell you, one of my highlights for me of this film still though is the Sheriff Duke. Glenn, how'd you feel about Sheriff Duke? The John Wayne.
Icon you should not be mocked. No, that's not true.
I thought he did a decent impression.
I think he did a pretty good impression of John Wayne. But I think it's, and I'm this is how I generally feel about a lot of stuff when it's doing a direct riff on someone, is that it's, like you were saying, it just goes on too long. How I think I best sum up this movie is, there are in sketch comedy like Saturday Night Live and Mad TV and SCTV and Kids in the Hall. It's happened to all of them where they have a good idea for a sketch and it should be like a 2 or 3 minute sketch, but for some reason they said, let's make this like 8 minutes long.
Yeah.
And that's what this one. It feels like a comedy skit that just they went on too long. But the thing is, they're invested. They have to do it. It's, you know, the show budgeted this much time for it, so they have to fill that space. So it's kind of what it is they, someone said, okay, you got this idea, yeah. We need you to make it longer and fill out all this extra space. And they didn't just say, oh, well, this is a 4 minute bit and you want us to do 40 minutes. That's going to be stretching how good it's going to be by a lot.
Yeah.
But they didn't do that. They just said, okay, we can do that. Mm-hmm. And they, boy, did they.
Boy, did they.
Boy, howdy. They did. I know. I personally liked it. He was a bit of a highlight, though. I think he showed up, like you said, I think he showed up just a bit too often. But I did like the John Wayne sheriff. I thought he was just going to be a little bit more in and out type of character.
And I have to say, my criticisms are with the script for the most part.
Sure.
I don't think that any one of the actors and stuff were necessarily, like, awful.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for this level of movie, I mean, I'm not expecting, you know, Meryl Streep.
Sure.
But I think that the level of acting you get is still reasonably decent
especially,
for what in other ways is a pretty bad movie.
Well, yeah, especially for the character like the Duke. And also, I'll say, like the Herman character, Scott, didn't you feel like the guy playing Herman, Tim McGill, he just goes all in with this character, though, doesn't he? I mean, he really commits himself, more so, I think, than some of the other characters, on what role he's playing. And I kind of liked him. He kind of had that old-school mad world type of tone to him, a feel to him. How'd you feel about Herman?
Okay. I feel like a lot of the people kind of went all into it, and mm-hmm. they were really committed. You guys were just talking about Duke. I think the guy did a great impression there. But, yeah, they went all in on it, but it didn't really pay off at all. Like, for mm-hmm. instance, there's actually a fantasy sequence that the Herman character right. had. And you don't yeah, know it's a fantasy sequence. Because it goes on so long, you think it can't be a fantasy sequence. I think it goes on for, like, 15 minutes or so.
I also think that's where a good chunk of their budget went. But
yeah, and you know, honestly, if the thing went on from there, I was like, well, I wasn't expecting that. Oh, okay. It was, and you know, that just shows how muddled down the film gets. I don't think it. I don't have anything personally against the people in this movie. This is my highest recommendation: is I do not wish any of these people harm. That's about as much as I can say. But I mean, like, honestly, it's like, you know, they, you know, and I'm very proud of them. You made a movie. You know, back in the 70s, where it was really hard, you scraped all your stuff together. There's stop motion. There's car chases. You know, that's wasn't an easy, you know, thing to do then. So good for you. But
well, especially back then yeah. they're shooting on film. They're not
right and 2.35 and everything. But you know, still, it doesn't alleviate anything else from the movie. So no matter if they're all into it, the character, the material that they're working with is still terrible.
They're making the best of the material, even though
I didn't really have enjoy. There was, look, there wasn't a single moment of this film I enjoyed. Okay.
Okay.
I'm trying to be I'm trying to be as nice as possible too, because I know that because I can tell where this movie came from, and it came from a part from people really wanting to, you know, do something. And I don't like to be like the dickish. I will not hide my opinion, but I don't like take any delight in being like the dickish, you know, negative film critic person like a lot of the people on the internet do. But I will say that there was virtually every scene I was just
Scott was hoping he wanted to turn it into a porn movie.
I just wanted this thing to be done. I was like, hey, you know, Kinky Kong is out there. Kinky Kong is a movie that's out there, a softcore movie, Kinky Kong. It's not a great movie, but it's funnier than this, and it and the DVD also has liner notes by our very own Andrew Shearer.
Just admit it, you like that because there's nudity in it. Okay, so
even the tagline of that movie is funnier than anything in King Kung Fu. Tagline of Kinky Kong is the what is it? The eighth wonder of the world likes to watch. That's funny.
No, that's okay, Scott.
I was just really miserable the whole time.
Well, good to know. This is not Scott's film.
No.
I personally found a lot of great parts of it. Actually, I liked the sheriff character, I did like the Beau Burgess character quite a bit. I guess I saw the potential there for being more. I kind of liked his character, and he does kind of get what he's looking for, which is eventually his reporter job, which kind of felt a little bit like Jim Carrey in Bruce Almighty. So yeah, I went there. I will fully recognize the fact this film is not good. But
well,
I did.
Not for everybody.
It is definitely not for everybody. But I did find quite a few amusing bits, and I did like that fantasy bit actually. And I was kind of hoping it wasn't a fantasy bit because I thought that would have been a really bold and move. But with as crazy as the rest of the film was, I was like, "This is awesome! This is actually really cool!" All right, and then it turned out to be just a fantasy part. Like, ah, man. Really? But this film does have everything. For a film of this budget, it does. It's got a car chase in there where they're chasing cars around Wichita, Kansas. You know, they actually have a scene in there that's a comic bit with a woman driving a girl who's just learning how to drive, and she smashes I mean, really smashes into a number of cars, which had to be a scene they could only do once because of their budget. And they actually have a large crowd outside of the world-famous Wichita Holiday Inn. Don, did it surprise you with certain scenes in here of what they actually did, considering the film of this budget?
It did. You definitely could tell they had a good amount of support from the the family, friends, locals, whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, this was Wichita, Kansas in the 70s that they're actually filming there. Well, they filmed in multiple locations, but yeah, this was not a Hollywood or California production. This was as local as it got back then. So it really did surprise me that they had that big of an audience looking at King Kung Fu in that final scene on the roof of the Holiday Inn, which, you know, the claymation I thought was pretty decent. I kind of got a kick out of that.
I did too, actually. It wasn't that bad, actually, for what you're watching with this film and what you expect. You're like, wait, that actually doesn't look half bad. I don't know if that was shot. That was probably shot much later, you think?
I imagine it was probably added. Well, I imagine the claymation was probably added later. Surprisingly, there's not a whole lot of information on this movie.
What?
I know, hard to believe.
How can there not be, especially since most of this cast, this is about the only movie they were in?
Yeah. I get the feeling that if it wasn't done later, then a lot of their budget went towards that sequence, because that's not an easy sequence to pull off. There was stuff, though, that probably was later. For instance, I don't think the gorilla originally talked.
Mm-hmm.
I think that the gorilla speaking must have come in much later, especially since I think at one time the gorilla quotes the "Make My Day" line from Sudden Impact, which doesn't come out till 83.
Probably. I think I'm not even certain that the gorilla was supposed to be talking. I think it's supposed to be like a narration thought sequence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
as opposed to actual talking.
To him actually thinking.
The best they could come up with was "Time to make like a banana and split." Yeah. Come on.
Maybe Eastwood stole that line from this movie.
Oh.
And that's why there's so little information, is because Clint Eastwood's propaganda machine has been keeping it under wraps because he doesn't want to be caught, and then they'll take all his Oscars away.
Look at that.
You heard it.
He wrecked office chairs, Sandra Locke, and King Kung Fu. I just don't believe
it. There you go, folks. A spoiler room breaking news that Clint Eastwood pulled the Shia LaBeouf, and he actually ripped off his material from King Kung Fu. You've heard it here first. Do some investigating out there, Internet. If you get a chance to talk,
it all makes sense.
It does make sense. And if you get a chance and you're listening to this and you happen to cross paths with Mr. Eastwood, ask him about King Kung Fu and how, why he stole the line of "Go ahead, make
my..." I don't think it's just the line. I think it's the line. And then he said, "Hey, you know, an ape that can fight, I can have an. I know a guy who has an orangutan. I can do stuff with that."
That's right, folks. Eastwood also, any which way you can and any which way but loose, are also ripped off from King Kung Fu. You heard it
this
here
is
first.
Ask him about that. I think it's a surefire way to get that facial expression he made in Gran Torino.
Ask him just so that I can see the clickbait headline that says 80-some-year-old Clint Eastwood kicks the shit out of a little. King Kong what? I'm getting my ass kicked by Eastwood. This is awesome. No. But getting back to King Kung Fu, this was an interesting film. Not a great film, but they did shoot some of the scenes on the actual roof of a Holiday Inn in Wichita, Kansas. You're absolutely right, Don. This is a community film.
Mm-hmm.
These guys actually got people in Wichita, Kansas, main city folk, to let them shoot this film in their town and kind of feature it. They even have a special song for Wichita, Kansas.
More than a town, much more than a city, wherever there's love, you feel Wichita.
This movie is as local as it gets for the mid-70s.
Yeah. Well, and I think, I mean, this is me just throwing out pure conjecture, but I think it may have been just easier to get local people excited about something like this because you didn't have the proliferation of, you know, everybody having a camera recording everything all the time.
Yep.
And there were still some, you know, in the 70s, there was still a bit of that, you know, Hollywood and just film mystique, you know, because it wasn't something that just anyone could do.
Yeah, you had to have the equipment, and you had to at least know somewhat what you were doing about it. And so, yeah, it's interesting how much of the community, but it is the time period back then.
I love stories like that, though. I mean, I think in Stillwater, Minnesota in the mid-80s, we had a movie called Resident Alien. I don't know if it ever got distribution outside that town, but it was not a bad science fiction comedy at all. And it was made in town, and you could tell it was all locals and everything. Around the same time that this film was being made, and there was a wonderful article on this. Ah, God, I want to say it was in Film Facts. About the town of Milpitas, California? Am I pronouncing that right?
I think so.
And there was a movie called The Milpitas Monster. Well, far more interesting than the movie itself is the fact that this town, which was always like the brunt of the jokes because it's basically where all the garbage was sent, and so it always kind of smelled like garbage in Milpitas, that every single person in town practically got involved in making this tiny little monster movie. No matter what the movie turned out to be, it was so inspiring to hear the story, you know? And I have a feeling that King Kung Fu, I don't know how much of Wichita chipped in to make this movie, but I have a feeling that King Kung Fu was kind of that same story, that the movie, as far as I'm concerned, the movie sucks. But I do like that local spirit. I really do. So that's one thing I can say in its favor, definitely. There's something to be said for that, because that's how... that's the heart of art of indie filmmaking.
It is the heart of indie filmmaking, and at parts it almost felt like this little low budget love letter to Wichita, Kansas.
Yep.
You know, and yeah, I think that goes along with the sincerity and kind of the heart that this film has. You know, is not so much maybe the material itself, but the fact if you look at what these folks were able to do in 74 when they first started shooting, and the amount of community that they have involved in this film. I mean, they feature, and you could tell, that feature the Wild West, which is hilarious because one of the guys who must actually know martial arts, because he went on to do a number of other martial arts films, the guy who plays Wild Bill in that Western scene, who's walking up with the peanuts, and saying, oh, you're supposed to be in the scene, is a guy who actually knows martial arts. and he doesn't do a lick of fighting.
That's cute.
But they're featuring it, you know, in one of those Wild West reenactment, you know, tourist attractions, which you know is in Wichita, Kansas at the time. So they planned a scene there to feature that Wild West reenactment park or whatever, you know. So it's like some of these scenes were made specifically to feature, you know, specific, you know, known at the time attractions or landmarks or whatnot around Wichita, Kansas. So, I mean, the film itself is ridiculous and not well made, but it does feel a little bit like a love letter to Wichita as well, which would be easy to, you know. It's a film that I'm sure Wichita, Kansas is the butt of a few jokes, so, especially in 76. So, yeah, King Kung Fu, I don't think there's too much more to say about this film. Outside of, if you're wondering if there is Kung Fu involved, the gorilla does do a few martial arts moves, does he not, Glenn? Well, kind of.
Kind of-ish.
Very little.
That was one of the biggest disappointments for me, is that there was a good premise and potential, and then they just said, yeah, but that requires some kind of effort that we're just not committed to doing.
Yeah, it was like they just had him like punch a person, maybe flip a person, and that was it.
What about the Kung Fu, Don? Were you at all impressed?
Not really. Not really.
Well, you know, he does do that kind of wicked kick, though, and he does take on the whole baseball team, which, again, if you think about it, that was them, I think, featuring a baseball park in Wichita, Kansas.
Something local, yeah.
You know, it's another scene at a place that they're trying to feature that maybe, at least at the time, Wichita, Kansas was known about or they wanted to be known about. So the more I think about it, that, yeah, some of these scenes were made specifically to kind of feature those areas in Wichita.
You know, yeah, then the more you think about it, maybe some of those sequences and scenes were added neither to feature locales in Wichita or businesses in Wichita.
Right. Yeah.
Like maybe people actually paid or contributed to the funding of the movie in order to have their businesses featured.
Mm-hmm. Right, like the hot air balloon guys.
Mm-hmm. And the painting.
And the painting place, too.
How much do you think Pizza Hut paid?
I'm going to guess probably not.
Pizza Hut is like features prominently in the early scenes of this movie. I mean, Ray Faye works there. But I mean, like, I was just like, as this thing wore on, I'm like, man, this movie is to Pizza Hut what McDonald's was to Mac and me. I'm telling you, it's just. I'm wondering, like, so either Pizza Hut paid to be involved in this movie,
lost the bet.
Yeah, or Godfather's Pizza said, put Pizza Hut in this movie.
or maybe it was a franchise and not an actual, you know, not the corporate building, but maybe a franchise, a local Wichita franchise, that wanted to contribute to the film if they featured them in the movie. You know, because the interior definitely was not a Pizza Hut. Though it was the outside was a Pizza Hut. I don't think that inside was a 70s.
You got to go really far back in your brain because they don't really have sit down Pizza Huts anymore, which is a shame because that's where you could get the good stuff. But it kind of looked like it. Like it just like kind of looked like they were shoved into a corner of one. It's like just don't bother the patrons, you know. But you know, I would have loved to see like those like the little chandeliers over the table that actually had like the Pizza Hut logo and stuff on them. But I don't know.
Yeah.
The Pizza Hut I worked at didn't have the Pizza Hut logo on.
Really? Oh, really? That's too bad. I loved that.
But it is. This is as much as I think, now that we're talking about it and you think about it more, as much as a love letter to Wichita, Kansas, as it is trying to be a comedy movie. In which case, if you take it kind of like that, I think it gives you a little more heart and maybe might be a little bit kinder to the film. But yeah, it's... As far as even comedies in the 70s go, I will say this is probably the most obscure film on our list, especially this year, but an interesting one. I'm glad Dawn suggested it and I watched it because there are parts in it that I really enjoyed and many parts that I will say were rough. But this is indie filmmaking, not in its infancy, but, you know, this is early indie filmmaking. You get this now. This is a film that if they were trying to make it now, would have been crowdfunded.
Yeah.
It would have been Indiegogo'd, if at all. It might have. They just might have tried to get local businesses and still shot it. You know. In fact, we're getting films similar to this today because people can shoot with their phones. You can grab any camera just about and shoot something. You know, in high def. And if you tell people you're making a movie, a lot of times, especially in smaller towns, that's going to be very appealing to people to possibly be in a movie, you know, even if it doesn't amount to much. I mean, after all, look at which Howling was that.
Sheesh.
The Lion Dancing in the Dark. That whole town was pretty much in on that film as well. So, I think we'll wrap it up here.
I think the difference between the two movies is that King Kung Fu was actually a project put together by the people of the town. Howling 7 was like a conspiracy.
That's a very good way to put it, Scott. So, yeah, we're going to wrap it up for the night. I think there's not a huge amount to this film. There's some heart. There's some great features of landmarks in Wichita, Kansas, and I'm sure if you're from Wichita, Kansas, you probably get a kick out of this film to see stuff that has been around your town and might still be there, and some things that might not be there. That Holiday Inn's probably renamed by now, probably the King Kung Fu Hotel.
So. Get the, you can do like fantasy suites and get the jungle room.
You can get the jungle room. So we'll go down the line here real quick, and why don't you find folks, tell our listeners where they can find you when we're not watching King Kung Fu. Don?
You can find me at intheaudience.net.
Fantastic. And Glenn?
You can find me on Facebook with Guy in the Bunker Productions, or on YouTube, Guy in the Bunker Productions, or just follow me on Twitter at Guy in a Bunker.
Awesome. And Scotty D?
You can catch me at Moviocrity.com, and you can also check out my web series at Vimeo.com/channels/Moviocrity.
Nice. And you can catch all their links as well as my stuff at specialmarkproductions.com. Catch us on iTunes. Please like us and subscribe. We got some great episodes coming up. Keep it here on the Spoiler Room. Subscribe to us on iTunes. We are on the Google Podcast music channels as well. We appreciate you listening in on our discussion on King Kung Fu, and I hope you all have a very pleasant day. Say goodbye, everyone.
Bye, everyone.
Goodbye, everyone.